Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist.
And I am Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist from Louisville, Kentucky.
It's a beautiful day here in Louisville today.
It is a lovely day. Let's have a day like this for Oaks and Derby.
Oh, forever. That's what I'm talking about. Every day. It is beautiful here today. And we hope it's pretty where you are, too. If you're joining us right now, it's 2 o'clock Eastern time on Thursday, April 1st. Kate and I were just talking about silly April 1st jokes. I've not had one played on me today. I guess you could have called and told me you weren't going to do the show or something.
There's still time.
Funny.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the topic of our show today, in honor of tomorrow's holiday, World Autism Awareness Day, which is tomorrow, and in honor of that, we're all supposed to wear blue. Kate, did you know about that part?
I did not know that.
You need to wear blue tomorrow in honor of all our families and our little friends through the years who have been diagnosed with autism. And so we've done lots of shows about autism in the past. We've talked to our colleague who's a pediatric psychologist who diagnoses autism about the criteria. That was, sometime last year. We did a whole series on autism in the fall, but today what we thought we would talk about would be the myths concerning autism in toddlers. And we're going from a couple of different sources that we located on the internet, but what we thought we would do is just kind of intersperse our own personal stories and our own histories with working with children these last 10, 15, almost 20 years, and just talk about that and hopefully give you some insights with that. And again, we are not meaning to be disrespectful in any way when we talk about some of these children, and I think sometimes when we share little anecdotes, some moms get real sensitive about that. Not ever the moms. I've never heard anything from a client on, that I've shared a story about. But I'm talking other moms sometimes think that we've been a little casual about that. So let me just say off the bat, we love the families that we work with and the children that we work with. And when we're sharing these little stories, if we happen to laugh or something, it's not that we're making a joke out of them or laughing at them. We're just sharing a little side story maybe that might be a little humorous to us, and especially today because I am really, really tired. So who knows what I'll say. So just wanted to kind of get that out of the way before we start. But I think one of the biggest myths that someone has when trying to decide if a toddler is on the spectrum or not is that they never make eye contact. And so you might see a toddler and, he might have some other signs and symptoms of autism, and we're certainly not going to go through all those today. But one of the things that children typically struggle with when they're on the spectrum is they're so hyper-focused on other things in their environment that sometimes they really lack that social awareness, and part of that is making consistent eye contact. So a child might look at you even for some amount of time, and if you're doing a little song that he likes or talking about something that's real fun and real animated, you might get great eye contact. And sometimes even professionals who might see a child for the first time might say, we can't be on the spectrum because he made eye contact. And that's a big, big myth. And certainly as children progress in therapy and we've seen them for a while, that's one of the things we're working on is establishing that joint attention and holding their little levels of engagement so that they are connected to you and they are playing with you and they're looking at you. And as Kate says, they have the twinkle in their eyes and they're really, really right there with you. So just because you've been able to kind of work that up with a kid doesn't necessarily mean that autism is not his diagnosis. Kate, did you want to talk about that at all?
I guess the only thing I'd add to that is that I've become more acutely aware of I don't know how to put it, if direct eye contact is somehow uncomfortable for kids who are on the spectrum or, it's almost like it's just really hard for them to do that for more than a fleeting second. And when I'm most aware of that is when I'm on the floor close to a child, when I'm up, maybe standing, and I'm calling their attention from, you know, midway through the room, and I'm saying, Jonathan, Jonathan, you know, they may look at me, and I feel like, oh, he's looking at me. I, you know, we have eye contact, but then when you're close to them, it seems like that really close interpersonal connection is somehow difficult. I don't really get it necessarily. I just know that that is something, you know, that we see. On the other hand, as you stated, Laura, when kids begin to make some progress, we see, oh, you know, and sometimes I'll make a note on a daily summary sheet, you know, increased eye contact. I mean, it's kind of a note to myself. That is getting better. And I think
right.
That's sometimes one of the things we see come along pretty quickly with kids on the spectrum and, you know, is important. And then the other thing I'd say is that a lot of times parents feel like, he makes eye contact with me, and I do think that not every child on the spectrum, but there certainly are those kids on the spectrum who do make better eye contact with, say, their mommy or their daddy or both. But anyone beyond that very inner circle,
right.
They don't very much, you know. So, and it's not maybe typical, but I think the moms or dads can make a good argument that, look, he looks at me. And it's like,
right.
Well, yeah, because you're mommy and daddy. But with anybody else, that's a really big challenge for them. And so.
Yeah, and the theory is, I think, that it's because of the sensory processing differences for children on the spectrum, that it's really hard for them to maybe listen and look at you at the same time, or it's really hard for them to break away their gaze for something. If it's a kid that really has kind of that heightened visual awareness, it's hard for them to want to take their eyes off whatever they're playing with or looking at. You know, if they're a TV or a video kid, you know, and I walk in, sometimes I really would maybe try to work to get their attention, and then nothing works other than going and totally turning off the TV and me getting right in front of them and doing a big hi, because it's so hard for them to visually move that attention away from what they really, really like. Ooh, my cell phone's going off. Sorry about that. Okay. But that is a myth. And haven't you heard professionals, Kate, that, you know, it's so frustrating to me when a child will go to for a multi-person evaluation and them say, you know, eye contact is so good, that's not one of the things he struggled with. And I think, oh, my goodness, you have no idea how hard we worked on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that in and of itself does not necessarily negate that diagnosis. And, you know, I had one little guy a couple years ago that I talk about a lot whose parents are probably the most social couple I've ever worked with. You know, mom was a cheerleader in college and dad just has tons of personality. And one of the things that the primary level evaluator, when they went in to evaluate him, said, well, we can just rule that off. This just needs to be called sensory processing disorder, speech language delay, you know, and kind of went down the list. He has some gastrointestinal problems. You know, he does some stereotypical things, but we can't really call it autism because he really is fairly social and will, you know, really look at you. And so, again, I think because of him, because a byproduct of the parents that he had been with, you know, for 2.5 years before I got him, or 2 years, they so worked on, hey, look at me, you know, called his name, and again, were so cute and so fun and such great parents for him that they had kind of worked through that piece, and that really wasn't an issue for him. So just because the child is making eye contact doesn't necessarily mean that he's not autistic. So that is certainly a myth.
Okay, one thing I'll add, and then I won't say another word. Sometimes I am aware my kids are old, so it's been a long time since I had that experience with my babies, but working with other children who are definitely not on the spectrum or even playing with typically developing babies, sometimes I'm almost taken now with how much they stare right at your eyes and your face, because
yeah.
Most of the kids, or, you know, certain percentage of the kids we work with, even sometimes language-delayed kids don't necessarily make great eye contact, but typically
right.
Developing kids stare at you constantly. And
I
find myself thinking, whoa, those eyes are glued to me, you know, because it's such a contrast to what we see in the trenches with kids who are on the spectrum. It's almost like, whoa, they don't miss a thing, an expression, you know, you're
right.
Raising your eyebrows and there's, you can see them watching them and think, wow. I think parents who, you know, say it's your first baby and some professional says, oh, I'm a little concerned about the lack of eye contact. I think if they spent an hour with the typically developing baby and felt that eye contact that's pretty much constant, it'd be more obvious to them, you know, what the difference is.
I have a little guy in my caseload now that I worked with the older brother. And, Kate, you work with this family, too, and his eye contact is what you're talking about. I almost feel a little on display when I'm there because he does not take his eyes off me from the time, and he's got big brown eyes, you know, and it's like radar the whole time I'm there. Boy, he is laser locked on me, and it is such an interesting contrast, you know, even with his brother who is still home, you know, on the days that I'm there, and he still really struggles with that, but not baby brother. He has certainly, who's two now, and he's doing great, but, you know, he's really, that's not one of his issues, you know, totally different kind of language profile than his brother had. But it is, you're right, when you see it with a child who's not on the spectrum or who, you know, is really social and is doing pretty well with that area of development, it is very, very striking, so... but again, children with autism, especially once they've been in therapy a while and you've really worked on that, really can and do make eye contact and can be affectionate. And that's the next myth, is that people with autism do not show affection. You know, and we just have kind of this stereotype that they don't look at you, they're completely self-absorbed 24/7, you don't ever get a hug or a smile or a kiss or anything like that. Now, sometimes there's a qualitative difference with what we would see with a child, because a mom might say, oh, he's approaching me, he's affectionate with me, and we might notice, well, you know, he usually just kind of backs into his mom's legs, you know, he's seeking her out, and yes, he's approaching her, but is it really the same kind of qualitative thing as a two-year-old who's going to run up to you and throw his arms around you and, you know, kiss you? Maybe not. But to that mom and with that baby, it certainly feels like affection to her because it's been, you know, their little pattern. So that certainly is a myth that children with autism are not affectionate, that they don't have what a parent might consider a close, affectionate relationship, because they certainly can. Sometimes it's almost exclusive to one parent or the other. Have you seen that, Kate, where they're just I don't want to say hyper-connected. That's not what I mean. They're kind of clingy, but again, there's a qualitative difference. But a mom might not perceive it as that, especially if it's her first child and she's never really had much experience with other children.
Right. Yeah, sometimes it can be more exaggerated, and that's a difficult thing to try and get somebody to understand. I don't necessarily envy a psychologist's job on that front.
Right,
trying to explain to that mommy whose kid is, in fact, glued to her, you know, going to her for cover, running to her squealing, you know, to be held, because how do you say he's not connected to you? He is, in a sense, but it isn't the same kind of connection that we see with typically developing kids. And it is, they sometimes... Kids, and certainly not, you know, I don't mean to make the generalization, but certainly some kids, especially in the beginning when they're, you know, we work with 0 to 3, so they're all young, but if they haven't had much exposure to strangers or, you know, even people coming into their homes and trying to play with them, you know, they're scared to death, really.
Right, they really are.
Yeah, you get there and they're, whoa, that stranger has walked in my house again. But it is a different sort of a connection. It's almost save me, get me out of here. I'm going to use you to avoid this negative experience, and not necessarily I'm coming to mommy for a great big hug, and I want to look mommy in the face. You know, it's just save me. But it's a connection, and that is, we hear that a lot in mommies. A lot of times initially when the subject of autism comes up, that's one of the first things they kind of cling to say, this couldn't be autism because, and certainly, I've had lots of kids on the spectrum that were very, very, very connected to their mommies and sometimes their daddies. So.
Right. I have two, or they may have little routines or rituals like, oh, he plays with my hair for an hour every night. You know, mm-hmm. We have this special connection, and it's even, you know, it's even more so than with some of my other children. He really wants to be with me. You know, really, when you tease that out, an occupational therapist might say, you know, he really needs that comfort of stroking your hair or feeling it between his fingers. You know, he's really doing that because that's getting his sensory fill. It, you might be assigning kind of a different emotional reaction or attachment that might not be there. And again, I'm not trying to diminish how anybody feels about their own child and the love you feel for him, and that you, you know, certainly as a mom, we all want that reciprocated. But again, there's usually a myth where, you know, people say, well, he's affectionate, so it can't be autism. And so that's not true. That's one of the myths that we're trying to address. Okay, another common myth is that people with autism are all geniuses and that they have some kind of savant skill, so that they, you know, people always think about Rain Man, you know, with the numbers, with the math. And or did you see the 60 Minutes show a couple of weeks ago, Kate, where they had the
musician, the pianist?
Yeah.
You know, he was amazing, wasn't he? Woo.
He was totally amazing. And he had, you know, he could hear a piece of music one time and then play it, and he could change it into different styles of music. He could say, we want it to be jazz, or we want it to be, what's another form? I don't know.
Play it in the Mozart style.
Yeah.
Any song he'd ever heard, he could convert instantaneously and play it in whatever style they asked. It was amazing.
Right. But every child with autism is not necessarily a genius. Having autism, though, doesn't mean that they can't have a special skill in some area, but it doesn't always mean that they're going to be, you know, Einstein is what people always say. You know, Einstein didn't talk until he was three. Did you know that they think Einstein, if he were alive today, he might be on the spectrum? And those kinds of remarks, it doesn't necessarily. And again, I'm not trying to be unkind or mean or anything like that. I'm just saying that it's a myth that all children with autism are geniuses. You know, some parents really get a little bit excited if they have a child who at two, even before they're really talking very much in functional everyday conversation, might start to quote an entire book or quote, you know, an episode of their favorite show or a movie, or they might even try to, you know, they start to recognize some words. And so before they start to realize all these other things aren't really in play and they're not developing across the board like they should be, they, you know, they get so excited and think, oh, she can read it too. This is so great. When we might look at that as kind of a red flag. So, again, not everybody with autism is a genius. So if you have a child that's smart and you think, well, there's no way he could be autistic because he already can label any number that he sees. You know, he can count and look at a number and tell me that it's 55, or he can, you know, he can't be on the spectrum because he already can recognize letters. He can already see FedEx and, you know, say that when he sees that truck. So again, that's a myth. Not always a genius, and sometimes those things that we hear about, that again parents get excited about, or especially grandparents get excited about, make us, or little red flags to us too. I'm not talking very well about this, Kate. Please speak right now and be more articulate than me about this.
To me, you made perfect sense, Laura. I guess you're saying that, you know, I think a lot of times with the kids I've worked with on the spectrum, they tend to have some very, very visual strengths, you know.
Right.
Some, whether it be, oh, boy, I had a little boy a couple years ago now who he could match any puzzle piece with any corresponding hole in as faster than I could. He, you know, just those really, really highly visual, leave the words out. He didn't have a clue about which word corresponded with which piece, but, boy, could he do the visual stuff. And I think those kids do tend to be, and we see a lot of, you know, one of our soapboxes that we go on about almost weekly is, you know, please don't do so many numbers and colors and letters with your babies, because we see so many kids who are on the spectrum who naturally gravitate to that.
Right.
And although it's not inherently bad, a lot of times we have parents really, really kind of spending an inordinate amount of time on that, you know, really doesn't mean or doesn't help a child to know that the word ball starts with B if they don't know what a ball is. If they don't know that that round thing is called a ball, you know. And
right.
They really
but they can
do.
Only identify it in a picture, but not in real life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and you know, a lot of times those strong areas or those areas where they have particular strengths, it's more than that they're geniuses, those are that we therapists call them splinter skills. And so that is to say we have these gaps going along their developmental continuum and boom, wow, he's really got that. That really interests him. But it's kind of the gaps that we spend most of our time trying to, you know, bring along and focus on. And so I don't know if that was any more articulate, but that's my two cents.
I think it certainly was. I think it was. And, you know, the thing with language, and, you know, again, a kid can read a word or maybe identify it only if it's on his little flashcard. But if he has a problem asking for the ball when he wants to play with it, or, you know, a mom might say to me, I remember several years ago I had a delightful little girl that, and I think I've told this story before, you know, she met me at the door singing happy birthday, you know, perfect articulation, perfect pitch. I mean, she's such a singer now. Her mom's got several little YouTube clips of her singing songs, like in four different languages, you know, that's just kind of her thing. But he, or she could not use any words functionally or really follow commands. But again, her parents had kind of been misled a little bit because they thought, well, surely this isn't a language problem because she can quote all this stuff and she's memorized everything, you know, and they were having a really hard time, you know, understanding the difference between saying a word and understanding a word, saying a word and even using a word. So, again, that's kind of misleading to some people. And, again, grandparents, I think, are the biggest where sometimes I have to really explain that. But then on the other hand, a mom might give a kid credit for all this stuff, and then a grandmother walks in and says, he doesn't know any of that. So, you know, go figure. I guess it really does depend on the individual family and situation. All right, the next myth that people might have about children with autism is that they can't talk, that they're never verbal. And again, we have already talked about that there are some children that are echolalic that are on the spectrum that can really say lots of things, but they might not use those words very meaningfully. I think some of the children that I've worked with autism, Kate, actually make faster and you know, rapid progress sometimes with words when I get there because we know what works and we kind of right. know which buttons to push. And we, you know, I have a little guy right now that doesn't have the diagnosis, but he's going to a facility to, my guess is that he will get that when he sees those folks in, I think it's in May. And, you know, I think I was telling you the story this morning. He does a lot of jargon, so I really thought, okay, I'm going to start just doing lots of these really repetitive, holistic phrases. I got it. I did it. There it is. Where'd it go? And my goodness, he is popping those out now and using, for the most part, using them appropriately. And he has been fairly easy to get to verbalize those things because I've kind of known what's going to work. So, again, you know, his mom and talking about, you know, leading up to this appointment that they have with this team to more than likely get this diagnosis, you know, that might be one of the things that this mom isn't saying that, but another mom might say, well, you know, now he's talking. He can't be autistic because he's learned how to talk. And we've heard other therapists. Didn't we have a caller a few weeks ago that said that, I think I'm remembering this correctly, that he's made too much progress to be on the spectrum.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it was the same. Well, I don't know. They blend together for me too, Laura. But there was also one recently about a mom, and she certainly seemed to understand, my child talks, but he doesn't communicate.
Mm-hmm.
It was about he knew certain lines or scripts from shows that he liked. He
right.
knew songs. He knew, but if she asked him, if he wanted something to eat, he wouldn't respond. If she asked him what did he want to drink, he didn't. And I think he was 4, you know, so
right.
she realized, yeah, he talks, but he doesn't necessarily communicate much to her. It's all kind of scripted language, so.
Right. Well, that certainly is a myth that children with autism don't talk because I think, you know, I can get pretty good progress with lots of those children, especially if they are echolalic and kind of quoting some of those things, I think, my goodness, physiologically, they can talk. They can physically make their mouth say these words. We just have to channel it in the right way. So then we're focused on pragmatics and on how they use the language and the words they know and really understand it. So, again, that's a big myth that children who are on the spectrum don't ever learn how to talk.
Big one. I see that. I mean, I hear that a lot. I hear parents, well, he couldn't be because he's talking now. Well,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why we do therapy. And that's why, you know, if children with autism couldn't get better, there's no way we would spend, you know, just from you and me, from a personal perspective, any time really working on that, you know, if that weren't a realistic goal for most of the children who go on to be diagnosed with that. Now, there are some children who are so severely impaired that they aren't going to be verbal, but they could still learn to use signs. They could learn to use pictures. So, again, they're communicating, maybe not with speech, but talking in and of itself does not necessarily mean that autism is not the correct diagnostic term that you would use for a child.
And as you said, Laura, one of my mantras is I always feel like kids on the spectrum, are great candidates for early intervention. And if I had to pick a subgroup of kids in first steps or early intervention that really helped me feel good about doing therapy and help legitimize paying, you know, the state and the federal government paying for therapy, it would probably be kids on the spectrum, because so often we do see them come in at 18 months, 20 months, 24 months, and they're really quite delayed, nonverbal, you know, not doing much socially, really very introverted, withdrawn children. And by 3, we're all saying, woohoo, look at this. You know, they make oftentimes very nice progress. So talking is not ruled out, definitely, and we certainly strive for it with each and every kid.
Absolutely. Okay, another myth about autism is that it can be outgrown. And when I say this, you know, again, we're talking about the progress that children make, and do I feel like kids really outgrow autism? I think some children get so much better that although they may not be typically developing their skills, you know, you can check those skills off. They may still have some quirks. They may be able to function in a regular classroom with not much support. I have one little guy that I saw when he was 2, who his mom and I are still friends, and he's in 2nd grade, but he gets bumped up to like 3rd or 4th grade math. He, you know, he has some real strengths. He reads on, oh gosh, probably a 5th or 6th grade level. He was reading as a 2-year-old, so he's hyperlexic. But he's doing very well academically, but he's still struggling with so many social things. And you think, okay, has he outgrown autism? No. You know, he will always probably struggle socially. And he may even get better socially, so that these things that he's having trouble with now, or fears that he has, or kind of sensory reactions to things. He still has a really hard time with the bell ringing at school and a fire alarm. You know, they have to tell him way ahead of time to get him ready if they're going to have a fire drill, so that he doesn't go into panic mode in that fight or flight reaction. But will he ever really outgrow it? No. It's a condition that will, you know, follow him. But will he be able to have a great life? I think so. You know, he's already bumped up at school and, again, you know, making really good grades. And there are lots of adults with autism that are married and have children and have jobs, and so it doesn't mean that they're not autistic anymore, but it just means that they have learned how to cope, and certainly the people that live with them have probably learned how to help manage some of those things too. Do you want to say anything about that?
No.
I do want to say, though, I am not saying that I don't think that autism can't be I guess I am saying that autism can't be quote unquote cured, but I do think that, you know, especially the moms that are really in that biomedical movement and that are doing all those things, would those children still be labeled on the spectrum or no? I don't know, because I think it really depends on each individual child and what point they, you know, how many skills we're able to check off and how well they're really doing. And, you know, again, I think you can't really generalize if this child would still be on or if that child wouldn't would no longer qualify for a spectrum diagnosis. I don't know. I think that's an individual decision. But do most children, quote, unquote, outgrow it? Probably not. So,
yeah, I do think that a certain number of kids on the spectrum make so much progress that parents sometimes hear from professionals, oh, no, he couldn't possibly be autistic. You know, they were wrong. And it's, you know, not us who diagnoses them, but say they were diagnosed at an agency or a big facility where they got the team assessment as a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old, and now the child's 8, and, wow, he's doing great. And, you know, let's preface it by saying autism is a very gray area. You know,
right.
You could have the same child go on a Tuesday to one facility and they would say, no, he's not autistic. And he could go on a Wednesday to a different facility and they would say, might say, yes, he is autistic. So,
or start, a different team same facility.
Same facility, yeah. different players, and you may get a different answer. Now, people don't like to hear that because it's not concrete, and I don't like it either.
I don't either.
Sometimes parents ask me, and I have to say, he's in the gray area. He might get it, and he might not.
Right.
You know, it's really kind of see who you get and how they, and, you know, experts say, oh, no, we use the DSM-4, and it's like, well, there's a lot of discretionary application in that DSM-4, and if you read what it is. You know,
right. It's subjective. Yeah.
It's very subjective, and that's the first thing. I've certainly had kids who, as they went on, maybe the big hospital group told him he was on the spectrum, and then they go to school, and he's made a lot of progress, and the school psychologist says absolutely not, he couldn't be autistic. And my thing is, I am more like-minded with you, Laura. I think. Are they probably still on the spectrum? Yes. They are just doing so well,
right,
that things are really kind of subclinical and they're not very obvious. But my guess is as they got older and as their parents grow with them and they mature, there are always going to be things that, even though he or she may be able to function very well in school and in society and even in relationships with other people, there are probably always going to be fairly significant things that perhaps they handle very well, but I don't think they go away completely.
Right, and that's kind of how I feel about it. And does it matter? No, because most of the time, you know, and don't you know quirky adults, Kate, who think,
absolutely.
You know, I've seen lots of parents of children that I work with, and the grandmother, you know, might come in or someone else, and they'll say, her mother was just like this,
mm-hmm.
You know, and did her mom get an autism diagnosis when she was a little girl, you know, in the 70s? No, because of our diagnostic criteria, not that it's changed so much, but just, you know, well, the definition has broadened than when we were kids, but, you know, does that mean that she, you know, she, as an adult, I am just really doing a terrible job today saying what I really want to say. I'm trying to be so politically correct and not offend anybody.
Let it go. We offend you. It's April Fool's. We didn't mean it.
Yeah. Okay, let me just back up and use really plain language when I say this. If her mom were a little girl growing up today, she would definitely get that diagnosis. Even knowing her mom now, I would think, oh, my goodness, how was she, you know, she not diagnosed? But the mom went to college. She's, you know, she has a professional degree. She has a great life by all measures that you would want to use. And so, you know, she, even though she's quirky, even though she has these things, even though people at her church and at her work and things probably don't look at her and say she's on the spectrum. They just think, oh, that's just how she is. But then as a professional, you know, you look back and you see those things and you think, yeah, you know, she would really get that diagnosis. And she certainly would have if she were a child growing up today. But it doesn't mean that it's a life-ending, doomed to failure, and never going to live alone or anything. Because, you know, she's a great mom. She has a happy marriage. She lives in a beautiful home, you know. Her husband is a professional, too. So, you know, all those things, she's able to really... She's coped and she's managed and she's done okay for herself. So that's all I'm saying is that there are still quirks, but they can manage and function and, again, have happy, quote-unquote, normal lives. I think we better move on before I dig any more holes for myself.
Okay.
All right. Another myth about autism is that the rates... this is the myth. Let me just read it. Autism spectrum disorders, this is, again, the myth, are not increasing in incidence. They are just being better diagnosed and diagnosed earlier so that the numbers are increasing. The fact is, or according to this source, is autism spectrum disorders are increasing across the globe at an alarming rate. Some states are considered to be in an autism epidemic. Many states experienced a 500 to 1,000% increase in the past few years. No one knows the cause or causes for the increase. Better and earlier diagnosis can only account for a fraction of the current increases in numbers. I think there are a lot of physicians that would argue with that, that that is a fact, because you know, we've heard lots of even professionals say, because we've broadened the criteria, because we've included children that when we were growing up would never have been included in that number, that's the account for the higher percentage. But this source says no, that it is increasing, but we just don't know why. And I certainly, you know, from a professional perspective, have many more children that are diagnosed or even that I think are on the spectrum than I did when I first started working.
Absolutely. And you've been working longer than I have, but even in the last 12 years, I am... of the camp that says no. And I do think that the fact that kids are being recognized and diagnosed earlier, and probably the definition of autism is applied more broadly than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, all that factors in, but I still think there are more.
There are more. And I had one, I knew of one child in clinic when I was in grad school that had an autism diagnosis. And when I think about all the children that were in that clinic, you know, in the, you know, or even through my undergrad degree, I didn't treat any child with autism when I was in school. And now I bet, you know, that's like it is on our caseloads. You know, grad students are probably getting experience treating children who've been diagnosed with autism. And even when I went to school in the 80s, it was still kind of a special diagnosis. You know, that wasn't one that you saw like you do now, where, you know, sometimes with the 30 families that I'm involved with, you know, sometimes half of those kids have a diagnosis or could get a diagnosis, you know, if the parents were pursuing that. You know, that's how prevalent it is. And I think you've had really high numbers on your caseload before, too.
Absolutely. I don't know, half. Probably at any given time, a third of all kids I see, I'd say.
You know, what I'm thinking of is when we had our playgroup program.
Right.
And we would look at those kids, you know, because when we qualified them, you know, they needed to have delayed social skills, delayed communication skills. So, again, that in and of itself made more children eligible for that program. But
right.
We would literally look at groups of, say, 6 or 9 children that were there at one time and think, gosh, half of these kids are on the spectrum. So that's what I'm looking at.
You know, if we only knew what caused autism, we'd have a really big podcast, Miss Laura. But
yeah,
when they figure that out, and I trust they will, because I think there's a lot of emphasis and dollars going towards that. You know, when, we don't know, but someday they'll be able to say, and there is some biological reason that it's increasing. I know that. You know what I mean? It's something that for some reason these numbers are legitimately going up. All those other things factor in, but I don't think it's our imagination, although ours is certainly not an exhaustive study. We know that 15 years ago, we weren't working with these kids, this number of kids on the spectrum, whether it's just our assumption or our belief that they are, you know, we're not doing the research or diagnosing them, but we know, sure seems like we're seeing more of these kids, and we are, so there's some biological foundation for that, and what it is, I certainly don't know, but we will someday, and we'll say, that's why it was going up.
Right. Well, they'll figure it out someday.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, another myth is that autism spectrum disorders do not run in families. We know, again, from very personal experience, in addition to reading what the researchers tell us, is that more and more families are experiencing multiple members with autism spectrum disorder than ever before. I've seen lots of children that I see the first child, and then I see the second child, you know, and even, and that kind of is true with communication disorders as a whole. You know, those things really do tend to be, have some genetic links there. So that is a myth that they don't run in families, because almost every child now that, you know, they're even at risk for autism, they haven't even been officially diagnosed, that's something that people are so aware of. You know, when we do that initial evaluation and you're talking about family history and they'll say, well, you know, my husband's brother's child has been diagnosed, or, you know, I have three cousins who have children with autism, so certainly there is a genetic component there.
And I haven't done any recent research into that. I remember doing it, probably 7 or 8 years ago, and even the numbers that I was able to find at that time didn't really reflect much of an increased risk for families with one child on the spectrum. And I would guess that the number today is significantly higher. I can quote what it was, although I hesitate to do it because I even questioned it then, but I definitely would question it now. They
right.
did not, the research at that time didn't really reflect that there, it was an increased risk, but not much.
Well, and again, I'm not reading from official studies when we're
right.
talking about these myths today. You know, we've just pulled some, you know, sources from the Internet. If anybody's interested in that, I wasn't going to post it on the website. Oh, and by the way, my website at teachmeyourtalk.com, I think we're having server problems today.
Uh-oh.
My husband told me that it's been down all day, and it's not on our end. It's on our Internet provider's end. So hopefully that'll be back up. But if you want these sources that we're using for today's show, send me an email at laura@teachmetotalk.com and I will be glad to send you these links. But again, I'm not looking at research while we're reading these. I'm just using these other sources. So there's not a number on here. And I do think that there are situations where, and probably a lot, where children are born into families where no one has been diagnosed. They have no knowledge of that. That can happen too. But we're just
absolutely.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Big myth, it's better to wait and see if a child does better rather than refer the child for a diagnostic assessment. I guess that would be on the whole, maybe he'll outgrow it kind of thinking. That is never, ever, ever better to wait and see than getting a child evaluated and, more importantly, start working with a child and provide some therapy and some intervention. The earlier autism spectrum disorders are diagnosed and treated, the better. I have yet to see a child who I couldn't say at least got a little bit better, even severely autistic children, you know, children that we would classify as having significant across-the-board delays, I think are always better at the end when we've, you know, when we're singing happy birthday at that third birthday or whenever that discharge happens to be, you know, from when I see them, when they move on to someone else. You know, I can rarely think of a child that had an autism spectrum diagnosis that I couldn't say these are some black and white things that he could not do before that he can do now. So I think almost always you have a more positive outcome than if you had done nothing.
And I would say the biggest disseminator of the wait-and-see philosophy, not to knock the pediatricians out there, but there are a lot of pediatricians telling the mommies, oh, he's a boy. Don't worry. He's just independent. Just wait until he's two. Wait until he's three. Wait until he goes to preschool. Wait until he goes to kindergarten. Wait, wait, wait. And that just breaks our hearts because we know that, you know, time is of the essence with
right.
kids on the spectrum. And the longer they wait, the more time slips by and the more oftentimes removed and detached those kids are, and the less likely it is that they're going to be reached successfully. And so we hate to hear, well, I talked to my doctor when he was 18 months, and I talked to my doctor when he was 2, and I talked to my doctor when he was 2 and a half, and he just told me to wait. And we're saying, no, 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 no. So it's really never, ever, ever better to wait and see on kids on the spectrum. It is get in there now and do what you can do to make it better.
Absolutely. You know, when I heard Dr. Esther Hess talk this summer, who is that person from the psychologist from California, and she said that there's a big movement in California right now to diagnose, or not to diagnose, to identify children as early as 6 months old that are missing their communicative and social milestones in hopes that they can get those kids in treatment earlier and earlier and provide intervention, because we know between birth to 3 is that critical window of development, and there's much more likelihood of children being so much better. I don't want to say saved, or
having more positive outcomes.
Right, right. Then, you know, the earlier we identify them. We've had kids on our caseloads as young as, Kate, you have one, and I'm kind of helping on this case now, but a little boy who missed those social things at 12 months, and his physician went ahead and referred. And that was awesome to go ahead and have that little guy, you know, who, again, missed the social and communicative milestones at that one-year checkup, and his doctor point blank told mom, you know, we need to go ahead and do something about this now.
Yep, and, you know, there seems like there are two ends of the spectrum on that. Doctors who are really on top of it, and the minute they have any concern, they say, let's just go ahead and make the referral and see how it comes out. And then those who, it's kind of old school, that wait, 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 wait. And
right.
I've dealt secondhand with a number of pediatricians, you know, who's with the best of intentions. Some of them have very good reputations, and I trust that they are very good pediatricians. But when it comes to child development, you know, they don't really spend much time playing with the child. It's, you know, look in their ears, look in their throat, give them the medicine they need, and, you know, see you next time. But,
you know, and the thing is, most of those medical things that they're treating do resolve. You know, most things that happen with children don't really turn out to be a big deal with a wait and see. You know, viruses are going to go away. You don't do any treatment for that. Ear infections, yeah, you're going to, you know, you may need to do some antibiotics or whatever. But my point is, a lot of the wait and see things, because they've had so much experience with things working themselves out, that they really don't consider the other opposite side of that is it could really be harmful to wait. So while they might think they're doing parents a favor with not getting them worried and not overreacting and all those things, you know, they really are making terrible recommendations to parents not to go ahead and be really proactive about a developmental disorder or missing those developmental milestones when they're really, really young. Because sometimes, you know, we'll even talk about getting a baby too early. You know, we'll say, oh, he's so little. I just wish I wasn't seeing him yet. You know, and we might see those children less frequently until they're, you know, and really work with the parents to get a great home program, really, you know, give parents lots of homework and have them religiously work with their children, you know, and then think, okay, in 6 months, this is when I'm really going to hit it hard and see him weekly. But, you know, pediatricians can do a real disservice to the kids with wait and see. Or parents who just decide, oh, I'm not going to mention this to the doctor yet because they just feel like it's not that big of a deal, or they feel like somehow nature's going to take its course and things are going to get better on their own. And sometimes that happens, but, boy, I would hate to be gambling for that to happen and it not. And you end up with a pretty miserable 2.5-year-old who's not talking, not interacting, not understanding very much of anything that's going on in this world. And sometimes those children, again, like we're talking about, are best case scenarios where they make amazing progress and we're all so excited and we all pat ourselves on the back. And that happens a lot. But even with the children who are more significantly impaired, still make more progress if they are in therapy and if you were doing something to address that than children whose parents did absolutely nothing, and they show up the first day of kindergarten and the teacher looks at them and says, oh my goodness, we have a problem. So, you know, you're going to want to not take that advice. And in most states in the United States, parents can refer themselves to the early intervention programs. And if you're a mom listening and don't know what we're talking about, early intervention is what we call programs for children who were birthed to their third birthday, who have a developmental need or a developmental concern, and every state in the United States has a program to address that, whether it be a separate agency like in our state, and we are called First Steps, or whether it be implemented through your local public school system. You can find information about that by Googling or using whatever search engine you want to and putting your state name plus the phrase early intervention in quotes, and you'll get information about your state program. The evaluation is almost always free. Isn't that a law, Kate, that it's free?
I believe it is, yes.
The evaluation is always free, and then the treatment, if your child qualifies for therapy, is low cost or cheaper than it would be if you were paying on your own. So I highly recommend it, even if you have a pediatrician who says, wait, go ahead and pursue it, because most of the time, I think we hear parents who say, I'm so sorry I waited, versus parents who say, oh, I shouldn't have done that. You know, I can't think of really a time when I've heard that. I guess that I wouldn't. You know, they wouldn't tell me that directly. But we hear a lot of parents who are so sorry they waited that 6 months or that year when they really had that nagging feeling that something was wrong, and they feel so guilty when they could have gone ahead and just pursued that on their own.
And I totally get it. Who doesn't want to hear their doctor say, oh, don't worry, he'll be fine, just let him mature, he'll grow out of it, it's normal. I mean, that's what we all want for our kids. That is totally
right.
A typical parental response, and I get that. And, you know, who knows, had I not gone the path that I have, and maybe I would have done it myself with my own kids. But from the flip side, if you still have that little nagging feeling that, gee, I hope that doctor's right, because I really am a little concerned, go on and make the call, because there's a reason you keep hearing that little voice saying, I'm not sure. But, you know, we all want to hear, don't worry. But in this case, it's so much better to go ahead and take the bull by the horns and see what you can do to bring your child along to where he or she needs and wants to be.
Right. And I think I was telling you this earlier. Yesterday I was home for this kind of recurring little injury I have, which is no big deal, but I did some reading yesterday for another project that I'm working on. And the book that I was reading is called The First 3 Years, and it's by Dr. Burton White, and he's been around a long time. This book is in its, you know, I had it when my oldest son, who's 20, was a baby, and really used it for lots of his recommendations about development. And, you know, he said he still doesn't understand why pediatricians don't think a thing about almost over-treating medical things and then just dismissing developmental issues like they couldn't possibly have some kind of consequence. But it might be the same, you know, pediatrician who, again, would order every test in the world for a medical problem and yet act like a developmental thing. He's not talking. Oh, gosh, he's 21 months. By 2, he's going to be talking your ear off, you know, for a little boy who might not even understand words, much less be using them. So, again, his caution was, you know, be very, very proactive as a parent if you think there's a problem, and really seek out that professional help. Okay, another myth. This was an interesting one. Myth: if you have an autism disorder, you will not have any other disorder. And the fact they have is autism spectrum disorders can co-occur with any other disorders. It is common to find a person with autism spectrum disorders who also has any of the following: Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, cognitive impairments, deafness, blindness, and medical or seizure disorders. I've had a whole little resurgence on my caseload of children with seizure disorders lately, and those children really, you know, we've had this discussion before, really do have some of those characteristics that they may end up with an autism diagnosis as well. So that's certainly a point worth pondering.
Laura, I'm going to put another one on that list. This is controversial, but I'm in that kind of mood. Apraxia.
Yeah.
I think a Big fair time. Number of the kids I've worked with on the spectrum certainly show some signs and symptoms of verbal apraxia.
And they almost always have motor planning problems, mm-hmm. too. Like in play, you'll see those are the same kids that lay there and watch the wheels turn around and around and around and get so mad the first time they try to hook Thomas to Percy and they can't quite get the magnet together, and they're freaking out and throwing the trains across the room, you know, because their motor planning is so bad. Or you'll see them work and work and work to get the little track, you know, put together, and they can't, and that's a motor planning problem that's really affected their praxis or their use of their arms, and consequently, they also have trouble sequencing sounds to make words that you can understand. So I totally agree with that. I think I hijacked your point. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that was it. No, that was it. I was just adding that to the list because I do think that those certainly don't always go hand in hand, but for those kids on the spectrum that seem to have the prerequisite skills for communication but yet still struggle to get those first early words out, a lot of times, if you use those apraxic techniques, they get them out pretty well. You
start
know.
To talk.
Yeah. Seems to work. Okay, can I do a myth?
Yeah.
I want to do a myth. Okay. Here's one. Autism spectrum disorders are caused by poor parenting and parental behavior.
Oh, that's a big one. We should have started with that
I
one.
Know. When you started with the other one, I thought this would have been my number one, but yours would have been my number two. So we're
I'm
okay.
just skipping around. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is a biggie. And, you know, I don't know that I hear it quite as much. I remember being...
But we used to. We used
oh,
to
absolutely.
Hear it a lot.
When I was in... Yeah. undergraduate as a psych major many moons ago, that was really still kind of being bantered about. I mean, that was, I think it really came out in 50s, early or late 50s, early 60s, but not that I was in school at that time, but it wasn't so long after that.
Those early 80s, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think you would hear any expert in the world say that at this point, but I
Never.
Do hear sometimes, you know, on a not too infrequent basis, parents say, usually mommies, and I sound so sexist, but usually it is the moms that I'm dealing with when I'm dealing with a, you know, 2-year-old at home. And they really internalize a lot of the guilt about some of the, you know, the kids that are on the spectrum. And they say things like, well, you know, I know he doesn't really seem to understand words, but, you know, he's my second child and I really haven't been able to play with him as much. And if I only had more time to read with him, or, you know, they really, really, really shoulder a lot of the burden for some of the delays that these kids exhibit. And that breaks my heart because really, normally it really doesn't have too much to do with that at all.
It doesn't. And I, when I get a mom like that, and today a mom said this very same thing to me. Her little boy is not on the spectrum, but she said, you know, Dad's name and I have really been talking about whether we cause this with him. And, you know, I got right in her face and said, this is not your fault. You did not do this. You know, you have an older child who is talking and who is communicating beautifully. This is just what's happened with this little boy. It's just how he's wired. And the same thing with children with autism spectrum disorders. For whatever cause, you know, we don't know the cause, but I just, when moms are like that, I just want to hug them and say, it's not you. You did not make this little boy autistic. You know, we do know that what mothers do during pregnancy, you know, is important. You know, of course, you can't drink, can't smoke, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, is there an identifiable thing that a mom or dad do that have made a child have autism? Not as far as we know. And we hope that the guilt that we feel as parents, I hope that that's never really determined, because I do think parents really shoulder a lot of that. And, you know, interestingly, it's almost always in direct correlation to how good a parent they are as to how willing they are to assume that guilt.
It's true. The better the parent, the more likely they are to say, if only I had done more, if only I hadn't eaten
right.
that tuna, if only I had whatever, you know.
Right.
And it's very, very hard to accept that there's any issue with your child.
It is. And I just want to, you know, hug a mom when she says that, but I always make sure I have their attention so that they know I am dead serious and say, it is not your fault, because I think that releases a lot of the anxiety and a lot of the guilt and really helps everybody then focus on how do we make this kid better, not the laying awake at night worried about what did I do wrong. So,
right,
there you
go. That's still kind of out there. So.
Yeah, but if you're a mom, it is not your fault. Move on. Erase that from your blackboard of mental images and move on, because you did not do this. So there you go. All right, I hope that everybody will wear blue for World Autism Awareness Day tomorrow. It's also Good Friday, so happy Easter to everybody out there, and we will have another show next Thursday, 2 o'clock.
Sounds great. Talk
All
to
right.
you later.
Talk to you later. Bye.